Good afternoon. I'm Professor Tony Massey, the Provost of McGill University, and on behalf of Principal Heather Monroe Bloom, it is my great privilege and pleasure to welcome you here to today's symposium on free expression and peaceful assembly. Let me begin by thanking Professor Chris Manfredi, Dean of the Faculty of Arts, for organizing this symposium as the capstone event to the four open forums that he designed to provide the McGill community with a formal opportunity to engage in thoughtful reflection and conversation about these core university values. I would also like to offer my personal thanks to our distinguished panelists for their participation today. The insights they provide will guide us not only in today's discussions, but in our own thinking about the future at McGill for these events. We owe a significant debt of gratitude, which I would also like to acknowledge, to Professor Daniel Jutra, Dean of McGill's Faculty of Law. In his detailed report on the internal investigation into the events of November 10, 2011, dealing with the tumultuous and disconcerting events that occurred on McGill's downtown campus on that date, Dean Jutra recommended, and the principal immediately accepted, that the university engage the community in a profound dialogue about the meaning and scope of the rights of free expression and peaceful assembly on campus. McGill is a research-intensive, student-centered university committed to the highest international standards of academic excellence and imbued with an enduring sense of public purpose. Freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and the right to peaceful assembly are mechanisms that should guarantee the free exchange of diverse ideas. No matter how different perspectives might be, we should always demonstrate tolerance and civility. A university must strive to be a place for open and frank dialogue, both inside and outside the classroom. We have to value the opportunity for the respectful expression of a variety of diverse opinions. At McGill, we must remain committed to the free exchange of ideas, even those ideas with which we take exception. A dedication to free intellectual inquiry recognizes that we must withstand those strong pressures that would yield to partisan posturing or political correctness. As a community, we must endorse critical thinking, encourage intense debate, and stimulate an adventurous search for the truth. Members of the community, faculty, students, and staff must be free to ask challenging questions and to express their opinions without fear of official sanction or censorship. If university campuses become places where highly controversial subjects cannot be vigorously debated and challenged through words, images, and nonviolent actions, then where in society can we expect freedom of expression to prevail? Sharing different opinions and perspectives requires a very high level of tolerance and respect. In a November 9th note to the McGill community about controversial speakers, which is posted on the Provost website, I argued that we undermine our basic educational mission if we restrict or interfere with the delivery of presentations by speakers who are invited by legitimate campus groups. It should never be the case that listening to ideas that we deplore implies an endorsement of those ideas. Lee Bollinger, president of Columbia University and a U.S. freedom of speech scholar, has said, "It is a critical premise of freedom of speech that we do not honor the dishonorable when we open the public forum to those voices." Freedom of expression and peaceful assembly also entail responsibilities, both institutional and individual. The university's responsibility is to encourage open and vigorous discussion and to maintain a safe environment where freedom of expression can flourish. The university must establish and enforce protocols that will facilitate the responsible dialogue in which learning can occur. We have a set of provisional protocols which has stimulated some controversy and which we hope to learn more about as the day progresses. Individuals, on the other hand, also have a responsibility to uphold a climate of tolerance and mutual respect for the right of assembly and the right to speak, even if you dislike the speaker and detest the content of the message. An endorsement of freedom of speech does not include a right to disrupt others or to interfere with or infringe upon their rights. It certainly does not provide an entitlement to engage in harassment of those who hold dissenting and differing views or beliefs from your own. Individual responsibility means that those who assemble must conduct their activities in a reasonable manner, one that ensures that the university's regulations and policies, as well as legal requirements, are respected and upheld. Freedom of speech encompasses not only your right to express, but also my right to hear. It is only through the interplay of mutual responsibility that freedoms of expression, freedom of speech, and peaceful assembly can reinforce our university values. During the next academic year, in the fall, my office will sponsor a conference on a related but not identical set of concerns, namely that of academic freedom. I hope that we will continue the important work that Dean Manfredi has already undertaken and build on the perspectives that we hear this afternoon from our panelists, members of the audience, and other participants. These are vitally important campus-wide conversations that need to be extended. So please watch for the notice about the event in the fall, and if you can, please attend. I would now like to turn the podium over to the Dean of Arts, Chris Manfredi, who will introduce the order of proceedings and the topics from his perspective. Once again, thank you and welcome to the symposium. Dean Manfredi.
Thank you, Tony. It's my pleasure to welcome everyone here this afternoon. 2 months ago, we began a process of engaging the community in a conversation about free expression and peaceful assembly, and I had the honor of leading those open forum. They were good for me. They brought back that latent part of the professor that's still in me as a dean, and I enjoyed the opportunity to stand in front of groups of the community that represented every part of the community, students, non-academic staff, senior administrators, and faculty. And we aren't finished our work yet. This event is the last public event of the process, but I have committed myself on the advice of the advisory group that's been working with me to meeting with groups and individuals separately to hear what their concerns may be, and I have done that so far, and I will continue to do that until June. The purpose of today's event is really to bring together individuals who've examined these issues from an academic, scholarly, and practical perspective, but who haven't necessarily been caught up in the local events that we have experienced at McGill, to give us an objective, outsider perspective on these concerns and themes. And I want to thank everyone who's agreed to participate. We started organizing this when the open forum terms of reference were set about 2 months ago, and it's always difficult to organize an academic symposium or academic conference on such short notice. So I want to thank panelists who agreed to come on short notice, who rearranged travel schedules to be here, some of whom are still actually in the air as we speak and hopefully will arrive in time for their session, the second session. I do want everyone to feel free to participate in the discussion. I think we've got a great set of panelists, and I'm particularly pleased with the final part of the event, which will have two of our undergraduate students reacting and commenting on what they've heard today and giving us their perspectives on it. I'm not going to take up any more time from the formal proceedings, but actually I do want to say one thing. I want to thank the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, which has partnered with us in putting this together, and I also want to thank Aaron Crandall and Emma Riche, who work with me on the open forum process, for all that they've done to put this together. Without further delay, I'd like to introduce the chair of the first panel on peaceful assembly, Antonio Maione, the former director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, associate professor of political science, part of the Institute for Health and Social Policy, a research collaborator and friend, and I'm very pleased that Antonio agreed to chair this first panel. Thank you, Antonio.
Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup, Monsieur le Doyen. Merci beaucoup, Monsieur le Provost Massy. Et j'aimerais aussi remercier les conférenciers d'avoir contribué, ou vont contribuer à cet événement important. Cet atelier cet après-midi porte sur la question de la réunion pacifique. Une réunion pacifique peut-elle se dérouler en tout lieu, sur le campus, sur notre campus? Y a-t-il des zones où des manifestations ou des occupations ne devraient pas être autorisées? Dans quelles circonstances est-ce que la sécurité des manifestants et d'autres membres de la communauté devient-elle des facteurs pertinents dans les réunions pacifiques? This afternoon, we'll be looking at the question of peaceful assembly and whether or not peaceful assembly can take place on campuses such as ours here at McGill University. Are there areas, places, in which demonstrations should not be allowed to take place? And what are the circumstances or the concerns for the safety and security not only of our university community but also of demonstrators in this kind of manifestation? To help guide us through this, if you'll pardon the pun, minefield of topics at hand, the dean has assembled three distinguished commentators who I hope will give us compelling and fascinating reasons to be able to engage in a lively discussion on the question of peaceful assembly. I'd like to introduce them in turn and then have them speak. We've agreed to the ground rules, which will be 10 minutes each. And the reason for that is that we'd like them to get their point across, but also we'd like to have lots of time to be able for them to interact with one another and to engage with the audience. Our first speaker is Abby Deshman, and Abby is director of the Public Safety Program at the Canadian Civil Liberties Union, l'Association canadienne de liberté civile. She has degrees from the University of Toronto Law School and from New York University, and she is director of the Public Safety Program of the CCLA and involved in all of the aspects of the association's advocacy and educational programs, including litigation, legislative advocacy, policy work, and civil liberties workshops for high school and university students. So maybe we could have used one of those here at McGill as well. So that might be the next step with Abby's participation. Following Abby, David Mead will speak. David is a senior lecturer in law at the University of East Anglia in the UK. He's the author of, and it's not an oxymoron, The New Law of Peaceful Protest, and he has published numerous articles on protest and public order. Not only that, but he's also consulted and been consulted by the Home Office and Chief Constables in the United Kingdom. He's been involved with the Occupy activists and NGOs such as Greenpeace in the UK. And as a prominent public intellectual, David has written for The Guardian online and been interviewed for both the BBC and CBC here in Canada. Finally, Bruce Ryder will speak. Bruce is an associate professor at the Osgoode Hall Law School at York University in Toronto, and where he is an associate professor but also assistant dean for first year. He's served as the editor-in-chief of the Osgoode Hall Law Journal, director of the Center for Public Law and Public Policy, and treasurer of the Canadian Law and Society Association. His own teaching and research focuses on a range of constitutional law issues, not only in Canada, but also comparatively speaking, and these include federalism, religious freedom, freedom of expression, and equality rights. So as you can see, our speakers have a wide and varied background on topics relating to peaceful assembly, and I hope you will allow them the respect to be able to get their points across before we move into the question period. So let's start with Abby.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here today. It's certainly topical that we're here talking about peaceful assembly. I was sitting in a coffee shop yesterday, saw a huge march walk by. My interaction with peaceful assembly comes largely from litigating cases, but also monitoring the G20 Toronto protests, as well as various Occupy protests. So I, of course, left my boyfriend with my computer and ran out into the street to watch the march, the police, everything that's going on. So definitely appropriate that we're here discussing this today. And I just want to say a note. I've planned to talk generally about our observations about protecting freedom of peaceful assembly in Canada, where we see problems both in terms of police, government, and courts' approach to this right. I hadn't had anything specifically about universities and whether peaceful assembly on university campuses was something that was appropriate, just because I so fundamentally assume that it is, it didn't even occur to me to make that point. Universities are places of expression of all forms, manners, and that definitely includes peaceful assembly. So let me just put that out there, and then I'll move on. So peaceful assembly is an interesting right because although there are so many particular litigation points or particular legal issues that do arise all the time in terms of peaceful assembly, if you actually look at the case law, it's not dealt with very much at all. It's so often collapsed into expression. And I think there are really key differences that come up in terms of peaceful assembly specifically, and that when we just collapse it into expression, we're really doing a disservice to the right, and we're really skewing the analysis, both from, you know, the university administration standpoint, the police standpoint, the court standpoint. And we need to really focus on what is it about peaceful assembly that makes it such an important democratic right? What are the elements of peaceful assembly that we protect? Why do we protect it? And how does this need to be recognized and dealt with when it comes to limiting this right? So there's two main, in thinking about this, they're really obvious. There's two main distinguishing features of peaceful assembly that really sets it apart from all the other expressive rights that we generally look at. The first is it's a group activity. Usually when we look at expressive rights that are being litigated in courts, you're looking at the speech of one person or a minority of people that is really offensive and the majority wants them to be quiet. That is not what we're looking at when we look at peaceful assembly. This is a group, right? The more people you have assembling, the more likely it is that your assembly is going to be shut down. And I think the group aspect to this right really imports some really difficult and really interesting and really important considerations when we're looking at limits on that right. So that's the first unique aspect. The second is that it's expression in action. Most expressive rights take place visually, your speech, you can hear it, it's music, it's peaceful assembly is action, and that is what is expressive so much of the time. You can have 200 people marching in a street saying nothing, carrying nothing, and that will still be an incredibly powerful expressive activity. And because of that, space becomes an enormous issue. Access to space, competing uses of space, regulation of space. We generally have a large regulatory framework, both within the university and within our communities, that say who gets to use what space for what purposes, what's allowed, what's not allowed. And freedom of peaceful assembly very often confronts these regulatory frameworks. So how do we understand this right? How do we make space for this right in an area that is already highly regulated, much more than other aspects of freedom of expression might be? And I think these differences really do come through when we look at restrictions on freedom of assembly, what restrictions we want to put in place. So the first essential aspect to freedom of assembly that I think often comes through in restrictions is it is inconvenient. Peaceful assemblies, by their nature, are so often inconvenient. They need to make a point. They have people. You're marching out on the street, and they're blocking traffic. They are occupying offices, and that is part of what they do. If you have a peaceful assembly, if you have a protest or demonstration that is not inconvenient, it's probably not achieving its purpose. The inconvenience is fundamental to what they are, why they exist, and why we protect them in a democratic society. So often we hear when we go to litigate things, we're tired of this, we're tired of the delay. That for us is not enough. That's part of the reason people are out there assembling. So you need to be able to have a healthy tolerance for the inconvenience that comes with peaceful assembly if you're actually going to protect this right. That doesn't mean that all inconvenience everywhere goes wherever you want, but that can't be enough to set the limit on the right. The second, again, I'm going to come back to space. Space can be understood as just generally access to public space. Is a university an appropriate public space? How do we understand public space? The tests in the law are quite convoluted for understanding public space, but even getting away from the law, I think we need to have a generous interpretation, especially as more and more of our space becomes private or quasi-private, about where assembly is appropriate, where we need to be able to do it, and specific space also becomes very much an issue. So, you know, I want to protest against the G20. I shouldn't have to protest 9 kilometers away where no one can see me or hear me. Being in proximity to your target audience or a audience becomes really important when you're talking about assemblies. And the impact of an assembly. So in the G20 in Toronto, they said, yes, we're going to give you a space really far away from the conference center where you can demonstrate. Don't worry, though. We'll set up video cameras, and we'll feed that video feed directly into the conference so they can watch it. That's not the same. There's something about a huge mass of people all spending the time to gather there together, to shout, et cetera, that makes an impact when you see it. And you have to see it in person, you have to hear it in person in order for that impact to be really felt. Video feed is not enough. And then the third is that this is a group activity. So there will be diversity within the group. And I think this gives rise to some real problems and difficulties when we see peaceful assemblies on the streets, because it is a diverse group. It's easy to co-opt an entirely peaceful assembly. And how authorities respond to a minority or a very select group of people within a crowd that decide that they don't want to express themselves peacefully, that they do want to engage in more radical acts, how they respond to that select group and what impact that has on the rights of everybody else that might be there, that might be engaging in perfectly legitimate constitutional activity, is a really live issue. Very often we've seen entire marches declared illegal because a minority in the crowd is perpetrating criminal acts, because they're blocking traffic, etc. And these are the kinds of inconveniences and acts by a minority that really put in jeopardy this right that I think we need to do some hard work on sorting out how we can have a meaningful right while still addressing these concerns. So I have very little time today. I could go on for a long time. But I want to leave you with sort of the 5 points that we're pushing and that we think are really important moving forward to keep in mind when you are formulating policies or legal governance structures, when you are reacting to peaceful assembly. And the first is very obvious. This one's easy to litigate under the Charter. Government or authority should not take actions to prevent or thwart public protest, public peaceful protest. So we have seen this time and time again that government is very concerned not about upholding the constitutional rights of citizens, but about preventing the disorder, the messiness, the inconvenience that comes with public protest. It is such a fundamentally important right in a democratic society that really that should be off the table. Public protest, we should expect it. We should welcome it in a democracy in expressive spaces. It's part of a vital democracy. It's part of the inconvenience that comes in living in a vital democracy. So that one's easy. Second point, protesters cannot be regulated into silence. So this is really where we start looking at the regulation of space. We start looking at the heavy, heavy hand we use to decide what's appropriate and what's not appropriate in public or quasi-public spaces. Freedom of peaceful assembly and expression has to come in to inform those laws, those regulations, those bylaws. We need to start from the premise that a public space is for everyone. That includes people who are dissenting, people who are peacefully assembling. And we need to somehow build in a premise, starting from that premise, into all of our rules and regulations, so that when time comes to really mediate what is this space for, that is an assumed part of what the regulatory framework is there for. Third, government and authorities must not only tolerate protest and peaceful assembly, but actually have a duty to facilitate it. And this comes in because space is so heavily regulated. For example, in the Occupy situations, we saw government stepping back. People were occupying a park, government stepped back, city steps back, says, okay, we're not going to do anything. But at the same time, they are documenting bylaw infringement after bylaw infringement after bylaw infringement, not addressing it with the group, and then all of a sudden bring them to court and say, ah, for 5 weeks you've been infringing bylaw X, Y, and Z. So instead of actively interacting with the group to see how you can accommodate this activity while still protecting the flower beds, ensuring people can walk their dogs through the park, etc., they step back, they do nothing, and because the space is already so regulated, they have a really easy argument at the end to say, this is not permissible activity. Same thing goes for police. Government has a duty to facilitate this peaceful activity, so if that includes stopping traffic so that people are safe on the street, that's part of their job. It's a constitutionally protected activity. It needs to have the same currency that we give to blocking a street for a marathon or giving over space to the jazz festival. You know, those are great activities. So is this. We need to view it at the same level. Fourth, any limits have to be objectively justifiable. This seems really obvious, but we also need to have some kind of understanding for what different limits are going to be placed in different contexts. So we know that property damage often comes with large demonstrations. And we need to be able to see that property damage in the same lens as we see all other property damage. Just because it's occurring in the context of a political demonstration doesn't mean it should be treated more harshly than property damage that occurs after a Friday night up and down the street with a lot of bars. I mean, my bicycle gets stolen, that never gets investigated. What is it about property damage in the context of peaceful assembly or political demonstration that suddenly makes us ramp up our limits and our reaction to this? So we need to be able to put that in context and ask, why is that there? And if there's no good reason to treat that more harshly than other things, then that's a real problem. And then, obviously, there are degrees in terms of proportionality. So if we're talking about risk to life, limb, if the protest is in front of a hospital and the ambulances can't get through, that's different than the limits that might be based on less life-threatening situations. And then last is just a general call to build within authority, citizenry, government, police, etc., a tolerance for the messy inconvenience that comes with democracy. We need to be teaching people that they need to take to the streets when they think that something is terribly wrong. Freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, even more so, they're tools of democratic grievance. Many people have the money, not many people, some people have the money and the power to be able to get their message out and influence policy through the media, through their contacts. Most people have freedom of expression and peaceful assembly. And we need, if we're going to have a vital democracy, to be able to have a space for this, to have a tolerance for it, to understand it and really welcome it as part of the inconvenient democratic country that we have. So that's about all I have to say as opening remarks, but I'm looking forward to having a full discussion after.
Alors, comme on dit ici au Québec. Et maintenant, j'aimerais inviter David Mead à parler. David va, entre autres, essayer de nous décortiquer qu'est-ce que ça veut dire pacifique, ce qu'on est très content de savoir, mais aussi de nous parler d'autres aspects de la réunion pacifique, y compris le rôle des forces de l'ordre dans ces réunions. David.
I was going to introduce myself in the same way that Abby did, saying what a topical time it is to come to Montreal. But although I did notice on the news that it's not just Montreal that is suffering, the Occupy Toronto group has moved back in overnight. And I also saw some tyre burning on the roads in Vancouver. I can't remember the context within which that protest was taking place. My brief is to stand back a little bit and provide a perspective that isn't Canadian, not avowedly Canadian, that isn't about the university context specifically, though it may obviously touch upon it, and is not about McGill, more about the events of November last year. So I have I've decided to focus on three issues, the bottom three issues there. I will give each sort of different weight. Abby has touched upon some things that I was going to say, so there's a slight sort of recalibration. But before we start, I've put there some working assumptions. I think we shouldn't forget, and perhaps this should be flagged up in red, that we're talking about a fundamental human right. Abby was talking about the right of peaceful assembly. I mean, I tend to refer, and perhaps we could discuss this, but to the right of peaceful protest as an amalgam of bits of free speech and bits of peaceful assembly, because I think there is something inherently different to both assembly and free speech that might be captured by protesting. Bar that sort of definitional problem, we need to bear in mind that it's a human right, and because it's a human right, restrictions on that right need then to be justified. So whether this is in my own country under the European Convention or here under the Oakes test, the scheme is broadly the same. Proportionate responses, no more than minimal impairment, is the sorts of things that you would be discussing and the sorts of things that I would be discussing, and is fairly standard human rights approach. I do want to offer up one question or an issue, and I think it's really important, and I got a flavour of this in reading some of the documentation surrounding the November protest, and we get this in the UK as well. It's very important, I think, to ensure that we do not define out activities from being peaceful protests. Once they're defined out, and the same with free speech, say perhaps with pornography, they lose any constitutional protection. So there is the world of difference between saying that isn't a peaceful protest, and that is a peaceful protest, but we should be able to do X, Y, Z in response to it. Because that then puts the onus, that second, puts then the onus on the government body to justify what it is doing. Certainly within the UK and within Europe, peaceful protest encompasses an awful lot of activity that perhaps wouldn't obviously be seen to be so. So European court jurisprudence in Strasbourg clearly identifies sit-ins, occupations, chaining yourself to diggers to prevent motorway extensions, running across a field when there is a hunt going on. All of those are captured by forms of peaceful expression, peaceful protest. Very few of them are then tolerated. Mostly restrictions are permitted upon them. But in most cases, those are forms of free speech or protest. Because we need to tolerate, there is a concept that I discuss in my book called coerced toleration. I would go a little bit further than Abby, who said a healthy tolerance of things. I think we actually are required as citizens in a democratic society to tolerate views with which we disagree. Because if we don't do so, what claim can we have that our views should in turn be tolerated? Goose for the gander sort of a situation. And I think also I'd go a little bit further than Abby in one of the points you made about the difference between, and I think we're talking about blocking the streets for jazz festivals and things like that. Again, I would take that a stage further. There is a functional value to free speech, to protest, that doesn't so obviously exist for a street jazz festival. I make a point in my book that we are very happy to tolerate extended queues outside Harrods overnight when people are queuing for the first day of the sales. We're very happy to tolerate, in my own country, football fans blocking the roads after a match. But we don't seem to be anywhere near as tolerant of exactly that same activity when someone says, but I'm protesting. And it seems to me that we should be more tolerant of that. And as I say, we should be forced or coerced to do so as part and parcel of living in a democratic society. In terms then of peaceful protest, what do we mean? I think we could probably all of us identify on a spectrum, obviously, activities that we would obviously be expected to tolerate. Placard waving, horns blowing, marching along the street, assemblies in public parks. And at the other end, activities I'm fairly sure all of us, or the vast majority of us, would say, no, that's not legitimate, that's not lawful. So taking the UK context, I don't know whether this has happened in Canada, sending all sorts of grotesque material through the post to employees of animal experimentation labs, or activities aimed at those who perform abortions. I think we need to think very carefully about where we draw the line between what is legitimate, what is lawful. And my own view is that where an activity is disruptive or obstructive, but where that obstruction or disruption is symbolic, short-lived, or incidental because of the venue of the numbers, we should be very wary about clamping down on it. It should be presumed to be lawful. So holding arms outside an abortion clinic for 2 or 3 minutes in the morning, agreeing that you would then disperse, but obstructing the people going into the clinic temporarily, symbolically, I think is a perfectly lawful activity and a means of expressing your views. But activity that is aimed at stopping the thing taking place, dismantling the very tools that are used or the instruments that are used in the clinic, or taking apart a fighter jet, is very different to standing outside symbolically locking one's arms. Certainly at European level, a couple of points that I think are worth making in the Canadian context. And again, I balk, coming from the UK, from Europe, I balk very slightly at this concept of an illegal or an unlawful assembly, because we don't know of such a concept in European court jurisprudence at Strasbourg. It is protesters, not protests, that are unpeaceful or unlawful. The key is whether they are violent or intend to be violent. So it is individuals that should always be the subject of responses from the police or from the state, not the assembly itself. Now, this is not always, of course, adhered to, but that's a very important principle that the Strasbourg Court has laid down as a human rights principle of effect throughout Europe, and increasingly over the last few years has also started to tolerate or accept that states should tolerate levels of disruption as part of peaceful protest being given effect to, necessary for it to take place. Moving on to venue and location, I shan't dwell too much upon this, because I think Abby touched on a fair bit. There is, and my own research is looking at this currently, real issues around access to land. We have seen, and again, apologies for being not as familiar with Canadian sort of socio-political developments as I should be, but in the UK we have seen an awful lot of public land sold off for private development, shopping centres, entertainment complexes, etc. And this, therefore, brings with, I think, two problems. The first is that people are unable to protest on those spaces because largely the private landlords will impose conditions of licence. You cannot protest, you can't take photographs, you cannot breastfeed. I've seen those reported as well. And therefore, that reduces the space that people can protest. But this has a double whammy effect because it creates what I call a differentiated reality of protest, because we are still able to see certain expressive messages, messages that the landlord is sympathetic to. So we get a very skewed picture of public debate and public discourse because certain messages are off limits, but those with which the owner has sympathy are likely to get space. In terms of occupations per se, we have had in the UK a fair number of court cases, none of which have succeeded. So there have been occupations of student campuses, not as short-lived as I think the occupation at McGill was. So this is occupations of days, and in fact in a couple sort of over weeks and things in the run-up to Christmas last year. All of those were success. Injunctions were obtained by the university authorities, acting as a private landlord. You do not have permission to be in this building. You do for the purpose of having a lecture. You're not here for the purpose of a lecture. You've breached the terms of your implied licence. And we have also had a series of cases around the Occupy movement in the UK. One, in fact, decided last Friday. But, again, those have all been successfully obtained by either councils or quasi-council bodies. I do think, and perhaps we can address this in the open session, there are specific issues around student occupations that perhaps don't necessarily apply to occupations of public or quasi-public land. And then the last point that I want to make, policing and security concerns. I take the view, and others may not, large numbers of police officers, security officers, are very good people, and they try their best in extremely trying situations. But some are not. Large numbers of protesters fall into that category as well. Want to have a protest, do not want it to become violent, and perhaps even specifically disavow violence. But some do not. Some have a rush of blood to the head. Some may be freeloading on the back for ulterior motives. I think the police find themselves in an incredibly difficult position. And I don't think we should underestimate the position that police officers face on the front line. They are trying to match up two almost impossible tensions. The rights of people to protest, either negatively that they shouldn't restrict it or even more positively that they should facilitate it, against order maintenance, the need to prevent crime, and things like that. What is clear, though, is that they should act only proportionately, they should use only minimal force, they should use alternatives where alternatives are available, so they should be as little coercive as they can in the circumstances. What we have started to see in the UK derives from practices in Scandinavia, is what's called the dialogue model to policing. In the UK, we call it the no surprises approach. In the Scandinavia, what happens at organised protests anyway, is that there is a designated group of police officers whose task is not to regulate the protest, but to act as a conduit between the enforcing police group, if you like, and the protesting group. They are distinguished by wearing fluorescent tabard jackets. This is all very important, and communication seems to me the way forward. But the problem, perhaps, that we have in the UK, maybe to a lesser extent here, is that that presumes there is trust on both sides. It can only work, a dialogue model, if both sides accept the general benevolence of the other side. In the UK, we've had a very troubled couple of years with discrete incidents, but of quite extreme violence by police officers, documented and put onto YouTube. Many people that I speak to have lost faith in the police, and it seems to me that if you haven't yet in Canada, you shouldn't, and seek to build it up as much as you possibly can, because I think where we are in the UK is in a really bad place to try and get up, if you like, to sort of an even playing field, then to start some model of dialogue. But I think, just a minute or two, maybe a minute to go, the real problem facing police is less this one of, or for protesters and police, the dynamic between the two, is less of trust and more of what I suppose could best be described as the implementation of law into operational policing. So changing the law, bringing in the UK the Human Rights Act and the rights of peaceful protest, or in Canada under the Charter, is only so good if those legal changes are given effect to within police culture, within police forms of behaviour. And I have, over the last year, had quite a lot of contact with police officers in the UK at large-scale and small-scale demonstrations. And I've been amazed by how little their sort of policing practices have responded to what I know are the legal requirements upon them. And I think it's problematic if that is the case, and doubly so in the UK, and I wrote a sort of an opinion piece a few months ago on this, that if training is the answer, as undoubtedly it is, in times of austerity, training is going to go. Certainly the clamour in the UK for policing and security is to have what we would call bobbies on the beat. The fact that bobbies on the beat are largely ineffective in preventing crime is not really the issue. Training budgets, I know, are being cut in the UK in order to ensure that frontline resources are not, in turn, being cut. And so there's this double whammy, the need to respond to these rights pressures, but the inability of officers to do so because they have not been trained in them. I shall finish. I was going to talk a little bit about kettling, but I'm aware of the time, and I think it's a... I didn't look at my watch before I started, but I suspect I'm about there. I'm happy to take questions on Kettling and containment, perhaps in the open session. We've had a series of court cases, again, in the UK and at European level. In my view, wrongly, but the European Court has recently pronounced that Kettling or containing large groups of people for up to, I think it was about 7 hours, in a fairly small space area, was not a deprivation of liberty. Forgive me, I don't know which section of the Charter this would be, but in European Court terms, it's Article 5 of the European Convention, and the European Court, in a case that went there, decided about 4 weeks ago, decided that Kettling was not a deprivation of liberty. It seems to be baffling, but that is the state of the law. Perhaps we could take that on after.
We will have questions on that because it has been used in the recent past. But before that, thank you very much, David, for again bringing home, I think in very complimentary fashion, some of the issues that were raised by Abby, and then also opening us up to the comparative lessons from the UK and the European Court. J'aimerais maintenant inviter Bruce Ryder à prendre la parole. Bruce va nous parler des principes des droits de la Réunion Pacifique qui dérivent de la Charte québécoise des droits et libertés et aussi comment ces principes pourraient être intégrés dans le protocole de McGill autour des réunions pacifiques et les occupations. So Bruce is going to at once talk about some of the principles from the Quebec Charter of Rights and Freedoms and actually also speak to some of the implications for McGill's own provisional protocol on protests and occupation. Thank you very much, Dave.
Terrific. Thanks, Antonia. And I'd like to thank Dean Jutra for envisioning this event. I'd like to thank Dean Manfredi for making it happen and for giving me the opportunity to participate in a conversation with you about issues that are very dear to my heart. And I'd like to thank doctoral candidate Aaron Crandall for helping out with the arrangements today. I'm a constitutional law professor, human rights lawyer. So naturally, when I think about the topics that we're discussing today, my starting point is that freedom of peaceful assembly is one of the freedoms protected by Section 3 of the Quebec Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms, and one of the freedoms protected by Section 2 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, alongside other fundamental freedoms, such as freedom of expression and freedom of association. So, in other words, we're discussing today a freedom that is part of the supreme laws of our land and of the province, norms, in other words, that are of superordinate importance. And I think those norms ought to provide the baseline, or at least the floor, not the ceiling, the floor that a university community should aspire to implement and abide by. It should inform, in other words, all of a university's policies and practices. At the same time, of course, freedom of peaceful assembly being a constitutional right and a quasi-constitutional right set out in the Quebec Charter, it is subject to reasonable limits that, to quote the language of Section 1 of the Charter, are prescribed by law and can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society, or in the language of Section 9.1 of the Quebec Charter, limits that may be fixed by law to safeguard democratic values, public order, and the general well-being of the citizens of Quebec. So freedom of assembly is concerned with protecting the public and collective expression of opinion by communication, by demonstration, and by protest. It's at the heart of what it means to live in a democratic society. It's also at the heart of the special role of the university in the development and dissemination of knowledge, the pursuit of truth and democracy, the pursuit of critical self-inquiry, trying out new ideas and challenging accepted wisdom and official policies. The unique circumstances of a university community, the unique role of a university community, make the protection of freedom of expression and freedom of peaceful assembly particularly important. So in thinking about how should a university go about approaching these issues, it seems to me the starting point and our focus ought to be on encouraging and facilitating, even celebrating, the exercise of fundamental freedoms, not on limiting those freedoms, although both celebrating the exercise of peaceful assembly and articulating its limits are both very important. So the institutional imperatives and commitments of a university should be directed on a priority basis, in my view, to encouraging and facilitating the exercise of fundamental freedoms on campus. And so that's my starting point for thinking about what does a good protocol look like, and what do good policies and procedures look like. And I also draw principles from basic interpretation of human rights documents like the Canadian and Quebec charters. First of all, any limits on the freedoms need to be prescribed by law. In other words, they need to be set out in clear and accessible rules, and McGill deserves credit for developing the provisional protocol and putting in place some resources to further conversation and dialogue about what a good protocol looks like. That's much more than many other Canadian universities have done. So that's a very important first step. We need to have rules that are set out clearly and in an accessible manner. The limits must be, again, to use the language of Section 1 of the Charter, demonstrably justifiable. In other words, the burden is on the institution to justify any limits on those freedoms. And those freedoms must be necessary to prevent interference with university functions or the rights of others, and they must impair the freedoms as little as possible. The concept of minimal impairment is how we refer to it in human rights law. And, of course, restrictions on fundamental freedoms must be content neutral, not tied, in other words, to the messages that are being conveyed in both the framing of rules and in their administration. And, of course, there may be some limits for hate speech, for example, or speech that has negative consequences in the form of harassment. But generally speaking, the rules have to be content neutral, very, very important principle. And not just in the way they're framed, but in the way that they are administered, which may be a bigger challenge. And, of course, what the Americans refer to as time, place, and manner restrictions, what we put into our concept of reasonable limits, are often very important when we're discussing the freedom of peaceful assembly. As Abby was talking about, the importance of place or of location. And on a university campus, of course, this is the key issue. And you don't have a right to express yourself or to assemble anywhere. No freedoms or rights are absolute. And so the bottom line in our charter jurisprudence is whether the activity at issue is furthering the values of democracy and truth-seeking. Expression, protest activity is ultimately aimed at conveying a message, persuading people, not at coercing people or engaging in any kind of violent or harmful activities. So there have to be limits, and when it comes to place, it normally involves a consideration of the historical or actual function of the place and whether other aspects of the place suggest that expression within it would undermine the values that in turn underlie freedom of expression, like democracy and truth-seeking. So if you think about a campus, for example, the open spaces between buildings, parks, squares, quads, etc., normally that would be a place where you'd expect there to be freedom to express oneself or engage in protest activity. Whereas in offices, classrooms, labs, libraries, and so on, you wouldn't, because there's a problem in engaging those activities that they interfere with the ordinary functions of those places. So that's a basic principle framework. And let me just, in the few minutes that remain to me, say a few things about the provisional protocol, which I think is a very good start, but in my view, needs to improve to be improved in a number of ways, and let me just contribute to a conversation about that by throwing out a few ideas. One is the title of the protocol is Provisional Protocol Regarding Demonstrations, Protests, and Occupations on the McGill Campus. Now, I know that Dean Jutra recommended in his report something along those lines, but he also recommended a clear statement on the breadth of freedoms of expression and peaceful assembly. And as I said, that should be, in my view, our starting point. How important these freedoms are, especially to a university community. So I would like to see a different title. I would like it to be called the Policy on Freedom of Expression and Freedom of Peaceful Assembly on Campus, because that's ultimately the core value that we're seeking to protect. So, and in that spirit, likewise, the opening language of this protocol, in my view, it's a good start, but it's somewhat tepid. It's almost grudging in the respect it gives to freedom of expression and freedom of peaceful assembly. I would like to see a far stronger opening statement or preamble that sets out the values and talks about in more affirmative language why freedom of expression, freedom of peaceful assembly on campus are core to our democracy and to the mission of the university. And there are many examples we can draw on. Many campuses in the U.S. have been through the same kind of process. I don't think Canadian campuses have done as good a job. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE, I find is a U.S. organization that has a very good review of campus policies and has a number that it gives a green light to that I think are a good model to follow. And adapting one of those green light policies from the University of Pennsylvania, here's what I have in mind by this sort of ringing language you could have to open a policy. The university, as a community of scholars, as an intellectual community committed to the free pursuit of knowledge, affirms, supports, and cherishes, doesn't just tolerate it or may permit it, which is the kind of language you see in the existing protocol, but affirms, supports, and cherishes, or even celebrates, freedom of expression and freedom of assembly. Language along those lines, I think, would be appropriate. The freedom to experiment, to present and examine alternative data and theories, the freedom to hear, express, and debate various views, and the freedom to voice criticism of existing practices and values are fundamental rights that must be upheld and practiced by the university in a free and democratic society. Recognizing that the educational processes can include meetings, demonstrations, and other forms of collective expression, the university affirms, encourages, and facilitates the rights of members of the university community to assemble and demonstrate peaceably in university locations within the limits of this policy. So that's just one kind of language that I'd suggest would open this sort of policy and should begin with the importance of the freedoms at stake and the university's commitment to upholding them and facilitating their exercise. Other elements of the provisional protocol that I would want to see more attention given to are, and I'll just pick a few examples because I know my time is limited. There's a statement that protest activity has to be consistent with any federal or provincial laws or municipal bylaws. To me, that's the wrong way to make the point. Of course, we're only concerned with peaceful or lawful protests, but a lot of municipal bylaws, even provisions of the Federal Criminal Code, are not consistent with the Quebec Charter or the Canadian Charter. The G20 story is such a good example of that. There are 1,100 people arrested, many of them for breaching the peace, which in practice is an extraordinarily broad and vague provision of the criminal code. I wouldn't want to see people shut down from engaging in peaceful assembly or protest because they're breaching the peace, whatever that means, because honestly, it's very vague, and I don't think would survive a serious charter challenge in the courts. I hope not. So I don't think that's the right bottom line. Any federal, provincial, or municipal bylaws, the touchstone should be the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and the Quebec Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms. And that's the way it should be framed, in my view. Demonstrations and protests may occur. Well, no, demonstrations and protests will be encouraged and facilitated because they are key activities for a university. We're trying to encourage people to be publicly engaged, to be thinking critically. So we shouldn't have this grudging kind of, well, it's okay, so long as you comply with our limits. I want a different tone in this sort of a document, in my view. And, of course, the document talks about compromising the university's ability to maintain a safe and secure environment and impeding the conduct of university activities. And I think it's generally understood that these are appropriate limits on the exercise of freedom of expression and freedom of assembly. But I would suggest adding the word unreasonably. Unreasonably impede or unreasonably interfere with university activities, because an assembly in some way is always going to interfere with university activities, and that people may have to take a different path to get to a class, say. And I think we need to have an articulation of an unreasonable interference and what that might look like. There were a few other things, like a reference to restricted areas here, the normal operating hours of the university. I don't know what those things mean, and maybe they're justifiable, but I think they could be spelled out with more precision, and the question should always be, are these reasonable restrictions for a legitimate purpose that go no further than necessary? And some of those, I'm just not sure whether that's the case. And finally, let me just say, I think it would be really helpful for McGill to consider putting in place a permanent committee attached to the protocol, a committee on freedom of expression and peaceful assembly that would have equal representation from faculty and students, as well as a representative or two from the administration, including the security officials, and would have a number of possible functions. For example, clarifying the rules over time, recommending changes to the rules, monitoring their implementation, because the devil is always in the details with these difficult issues, issuing advisory opinions, identifying best practices at other institutions, helping mediate any conflicts that are arising, and hopefully before they arise, reviewing administrative actions, and protesters' actions. And I see a committee of this nature having a very important role in keeping channels of communication open, in rebuilding trust, and continuing the dialogue that we're going through today, because we're not going to resolve these issues today. It's going to be an ongoing challenge. So let me just conclude by saying Dean Jutra, in his report, emphasized the importance of dialogue and communication to clarifying the uncertain limits of freedom of assembly and expression on campus, the need to rebuild trust, to be able to respond to new challenges. And this dialogue has to be ongoing and institutionalized, in my view. The legacy of 1110 and other events during the past academic year would then be for McGill to take a leadership role, a constructive leadership role, in advancing democratic rights on campus and solidifying McGill's international standing as a scholarly community committed to free and open debate and protest in principle and in practice. Thank you very much.
I think the administrators here should be getting Bruce's fee in the mail for having gone through that provisional report with such great thoughtfulness and detail. Thank you very much, Bruce. Merci beaucoup. We are now going to transition to the Q&A portion of the afternoon for this panel on peaceful assembly. So I'm hoping that it will be as peaceful as the spirit in which our commentators have presented their own thoughts. A few themes recurred in the three presentations, particularly the question of collective rights and the idea of the fundamental human rights that are inscribed or reflected in peaceful protest, the politics of place, and the tensions of that in peaceful process, and also the idea or the sense of tension between some pretty important concepts that were raised. And we heard from all three of our speakers the question of this tension between rights and order, the importance of dialogue, the very fragile nature of trust, and how that can be destroyed, and also how difficult it is to rebuild. And we also heard from Bruce about the specificity of the university environment in all of these questions. So I'm going to open up the floor, and since I am in charge, at least in this little space, I'm going to impose my own rules, which is that we'd like you to ask a question and address the question to all the panelists or to one of the panelists.
And I think if the panelists don't mind, I'd like to get a few questions on the table and then have you been able to respond in that way. All right? So we're here to have a dialogue, which means also no speeches. It means getting your point across efficiently and effectively. And why don't you tell us your name and where you're from as well? Let's start.
Hi, my name is Ellie.
Hi, Ellie.
I'm a philosophy student. My comment actually is not does not really meet your description. Would you like me to...
Oh, which part of my description doesn't it meet?
My comment was more over addressing some of the remarks that Ms. Deshman made and that Professor Massey made in his introductory remarks.
Oh. Okay, is it a short comment?
I can make it short.
You can, Elliot, if you can make it short, we'll listen to it.
Well, Ms. Deshman's analysis focused on a democratic government. I would like to point out that this university is not democratic. This decision will be made by the principal and board of governors, which is completely unrepresentative of the individuals in this room. The second comment is that Ms. Deshman said that it would be obvious that at a university these values would be cherished. I would like to point out the abysmal record of this university in restricting freedom of expression and peaceful assembly this year. First and foremost, the striking union had an injunction faced against them. Students have been banned from campus for up to 5 days. Students have been threatened repeatedly with the police being called. Students have been followed by security officers. Students have been called out and spoken to on a name basis, which I find intimidating when this security officer repeatedly calls me by my first name when he walks by me on campus. Students have had many disciplinary hearings, including myself, for peaceful assembly. Students have had, on the first day of our sit-in, a letter stating that our actions were certainly contrary to the rules and we would have disciplinary hearings and potentially in infraction of city laws. And so there is the possibility of legal action in addition to university action. And so there is a record of not only cherishing these values, but clear intimidation of protesting students and repression for students who have protested okay. with disciplinary hearings. And I wanted to point that out.
Okay. Elliot, thanks for your comment. What we'll do is we're going to take a number of comments, and I think that we're also going to ask Professor Ryder Bruce to weigh in here on some of the comments, perhaps, and if that Elliot has made. Next.
My name is Sam Goldberg. I'm a McGill alumnus as well as a retired history teacher. I'd like to just quickly begin by way of analogy. In the mid-19th century, the American Supreme Court under Chief Justice Marshall ruled that the provisions in the article, in the Charter, in the American Constitution, the Bill of Rights, did not apply to atheists, because freedom of religion does not mean freedom of no religion. And so the case brought to the court by an atheist lost. Now, the reason I'm suggesting that is it seems to me that the difficulties we're discussing, and which I think was illustrated by the previous questioner, is that we get into situations where the rights of one group are contrasted with the obligations of the other. And that makes dialogue almost impossible because it's almost as if we're talking different languages. And so what mechanisms can the law or democratic societies provide so that the dialogue becomes meaningful, that the rights of one are balanced with the rights of others, the rights of obligations are equal as well? Because as long as we talk at cross purposes, we're going to get into all of these sticky situations. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that we haven't got a proper mechanism to reconcile them peacefully and democratically.
Thank you, Sam. I'm sure all three of the panelists will have something to say on that very provocative question.
Hi, my name is Patrick. I'm both an employee and an alumni here. My question is, what happens when rights apparently conflict? And if I can use a concrete example, if I live downtown and right now my sleep is being interrupted by the nocturnal daily protests of students. Yes, fine, one, two times I can demonstrate a healthy tolerance. But at what point does it become that my rights are now being violated in terms of, you know, I pay taxes for this area and I can't sleep because of that?
Okay, thanks very much. And Abby raised this a little bit, but I think again, this is, you're all asking questions that everyone's going to want to get their teeth into, which is great.
Renee Siebert, Geography in the School of Environment. I'd like the panelists' opinion on freedom of expression, including freedom from surveillance. And I think we have quite a bit of creeping surveillance on campus right now.
All right. Freedom from.
Eric Kaplan. I'd like to hear the panelists talk a little bit about. It seemed like the whole conversation was based on, you know, blanket rights to peaceful protest or demonstration, and that these should be protected and cultivated. And the more I've thought about it during the course of the events of this year, the more I've come to my own personal conclusion that there is an issue of situation, of context, and I was just wondering to what extent that can figure into our deliberations and into the policy that we should have. I'll give you a couple examples of
only
what
one.
I'll need two. I'll give you two.
Two short examples.
Okay, so in terms of the general student protest against tuition, I think my own personal feeling is there gets to be a point where you have had a number of protests, and if you have not managed to convince society that your point of view is correct, there perhaps should be a limit set on how much you can disturb the natural flow of traffic in the downtown area. Right? Now, in terms of the general McGill context, it strikes me that the situation of what you're protesting should govern the action and what you're allowed to do and not allowed to do. So, for example, if you're protesting the closure of the architectural cafe, then you occupy the space in which the architectural cafe existed. To me, that is a logical protest. But if you take over Mort's... something in relation to Senate.
No, that was me who turned off the mic.
Something in relation to the Senate. And I also wonder if there isn't a principle of how significant your cause is and how it relates to how much you can disturb the natural flow of things. So if you're protesting the closure of a cafe, maybe your rights are not as extensive as if you're protesting, let's say, the destruction of democracy on campus, which is a much broader idea or concept.
I'm going to ask the other three, and there's a fourth question. We're just going to, I think we have so much now to cover with the questions that have been asked. If you could just take your seats, and then I'll come right back to you once we've had a first go around, because otherwise I think the panelists will get overwhelmed, and so I think will the audience. There are two ways of going about it. We could do it point by point, or we could have each of you speak. I prefer actually to hear each of you speak, but in reverse order, several of the questions pertain specifically to the McGill example, which Bruce has been looking at a little bit more thoroughly. So let's start with Bruce from the more narrow and then build our way up.
Thanks, Antonia. Just a few quick comments. My understanding of the McGill situation is very limited. I appreciated Sam, I don't know where Sam is, Sam's comments. And Ellie's comments about how difficult the experience has been in the past year. And I can't really speak to that, but I do feel that the difficulty of the experiences in the past year do underline the importance of moving forward in a constructive manner, putting in place policies and procedures that are likely to build trust and respond to Ellie's concern that students don't feel that they're part of the process of addressing these issues and that they're bearing the brunt of what they feel to be interferences with their rights on campus. So that's another reason why I want to underline going forward, trying to move forward in a positive way. I think it would be really valuable to consider as part of the policy or protocol to have a committee in place that has real power to review, recommend changes, and monitor the situation on an ongoing basis. And it has equal number of representatives from students and faculty. And also the very formulation of the protocol, of course, should involve input from student organizations. But many of the other comments relate to limits on freedom of expression and freedom of assembly, and there are limits, and certainly speaking as a lawyer, those limits are articulated contextually and by reference to the values that I described. So for the courts, the weight of the importance of the activity in question depends on its connection to democracy and truth-seeking or self-realization, if we're talking about especially artistic forms of expression. And then on the other side, of course, particularly on campus, we need to be able to protect the core activities of the campus and people who are insisting on occupying private offices or classrooms when classes are in process, or meetings when they're in process, or labs or libraries or computer facilities or the like. That's, I think, a relatively easily established reasonable limit on the exercise of the freedom. But it's equally important for the university to articulate and facilitate, I think, the exercise of freedom of expression and freedom of assembly by designating spaces where normally one is free to engage in expressive and protest activity. Not just articulate the places where it's not, because again, I think that's inconsistent with the spirit that should guide such a policy. Can we draw lines between what we consider to be valuable issues or expression and others? I think that leads down a pretty dangerous slope to have institutions seeking to arbiter what's valuable expression or not, although it is part of the context, I think, to decide. And because the weight we give to the freedom, it depends on its connection to democracy and truth-seeking, and the weight we give on expressing those views in a particular place will depend on the nature of the issue. So if you are protesting the closing of a particular site, for example, you need to be able to protest there and reach the audience, I think. I think that's enough for me for now.
David.
I'll try and address each of the questions, but not necessarily in the same depth. And I'm loath to offer views on McGill, nor particularly the experiences of last November in response to Elliot's question. But I would make this general comment. I think that one of the problems with peaceful protest, free speech, is not simply restrictions, but the perception that restrictions might be applied, what's normally referred to as the chilling effect on people. And this has certainly given rise to litigation in European level and within the UK. And it might also touch to, apologies, I think I suspect I didn't scribble that down quite right, your question about surveillance, because several of the cases that have been litigated in the UK have involved surveillance of protesters coming out of meetings. Some haven't become cases. There is, and again, apologies, I don't know how much you follow these things in Britain, but something that blew up last year was undercover surveillance almost exclusively by the Metropolitan Police, who had put officers embedded into certain groups, direct action groups, environmental protests, most usually. And it blew up because a case was being brought against 140-something protesters who tried to take over a power station. And on the night before the trial, the CPS, the prosecuting authorities, were forced to disclose that much of the material had come from an undercover police officer, which they hadn't disclosed for about 2 or 3 years. And this, the ripple effect, and it became, oh yeah, we've got another one, and we've got another one as well in that group, and there are large numbers of officers. So that then creates the problem. So this isn't necessarily an answer to the question, but I think there's a real issue around how protesters perceive they might get into trouble, even if they might not get into trouble. Sam, your question about what mechanisms are there? I think, you know, the first, it's not really a mechanism, but is meetings such as this. I think it's crucially important that people are able to debate the value of free speech and of protest. In fact, it's one of the claims I made in my book that this is exactly what was needed in the UK. We needed a commission on protest in the UK so that people were able to air their views and perhaps to see that there is more to protest, perhaps than meets the eye. And perhaps, Patrick, to take your question about disturbed sleep. And I know that was an example rather than a more general point. Of the issues that are in play, I make a slightly sort of facetious comment in my book, but which has some strength behind it, that much of the case law in the UK and at European level seems to balance what I call the right to go shopping against the right to protest, such that large numbers of people on a Saturday afternoon say, I don't want that march going down the high street because I want to go about my business. Now, there isn't a right to go about your business. There isn't a right to go shopping. And I think it's really important that when we are looking at rights, we properly categorise things as rights that are rights and things that are then offset against them as societal interests or concerns, etc., rather than as rights. There is a real battle of rights between privacy and free speech. That is a true battle of rights. But I'm not sure that it is a battle of rights when I don't want to be disturbed by your protest because, and this goes a little bit to my point that I made about coerced toleration. Again, I use the phrase in my book, NIMBYs, but with a silent P. Again, apologies if this is familiar, but we have the phrase in the UK, not in my backyard. I'm quite happy with big planning developments, but I don't want one next door to me. So I have turned this into PNIMBYs. I like protests, but not in my backyard. I'm fully supportive of your right to go protest. And you see this quite a lot in the discourse on bulletin boards and on blogs. I'm more than happy for people to have protests, but I just don't want this one, because this one I don't like, or this one affects me. And I think we are in real difficulties where we start to categorise protests as their effect on things that I don't like or their effect on individuals, and then perhaps start to guise those as rights. They're very important, and I'm sorry, I haven't got my glasses on. But Patrick, about your sleep, and I'm not trying to diminish. But I'm not trying to diminish it at all, and I hope I'm not trying to give that impression. But I think we need to be really careful when we're offsetting things against whatever right that is, that we are truly offsetting rights and not just good things that we'd all like to have, because the equation is very different. In terms, Eric, of the points that you were making, I mean, I would agree with Bruce. I think we're on very dangerous ground when we start to categorise concerns as important or not important. They may not be important to us, but they might be very important to the person. And although free speech and protest have very important instrumental roles to play, and that's usually given, usually cited as why we think they are good things, with a big G and a big T, they have important autonomy. There's an important basis in autonomy as well. And I think that's an important thing about the effectiveness of a protest. It's a very difficult line if people are starting to be dictated to about where their protest should be held if it's not going to be effective. It ought to be, or certainly the presumption should be, that that is the protester's choice, and we should work a system around that. I think I'll finish on.
Thank you so much, David.
So I will also try and hit all of these questions inadequately, each one, I'm sure. So for the first one, I, like everyone else, disclaimer, in Toronto, I don't have a good sense. I don't have my finger on the pulse of this university community. But having said that, McGill is not a democratically elected governed institution. That's true. There's no magic in our democratic representatives. Being a lawyer that writes daily to our elected politicians, I guarantee you that democracy itself is not an answer to these issues and these problems. I also want to say that it is a public institution. It is a public institution with a very specific mandate that should underscore the importance of freedom of expression and peaceful assembly. The fact that, in many people's opinion, it is not living up to that mandate, to those purposes, to the public nature of the institution, is a problem and needs to be addressed. And just to move quickly to the second question, so what can we do? What mechanisms are there? I think the very first thing you have is an agreement on principles. If there is a fundamental disagreement as to whether a university is a space for free expression, for peaceful assembly, for fostering these values, for encouraging dissent, critical reflection, expression in all its forms, then you really do have a problem. If you can't agree on that, you're not going to be able to sort out the differences. So that has to be the starting point of the discussion. There is various case law on whether the Charter of Rights and Freedoms applies to universities and when, but I am actually of the opinion, and we're litigating it now, that universities, when they do take actions against students for expressive activities, are absolutely subject to the Charter and need to be bound and uphold those values. So it's not democratically elected. To me, that doesn't make a real difference here. It needs to abide by these principles. There are laws that apply, and it needs to live up to both the legal and philosophical commitments that we make when we have a public institution like university. So first, you need an agreement on principles. And I think the Charter, Quebec Charter, are starting points. You need to get those down, and then you need to have a mechanism to sort out disagreements. So you need to have, the devil is in the details, you do need to have some way of saying, these are the principles we live by, these are also interests and concerns we have, can we reconcile them, can we find a way of accommodating both these principles, both our rights and these interests? If not, where does the rubber meet the road? You need to have those mechanisms in place in order to do the detailed work and discussion and dialogue that's necessary to say, what do these mean concretely? So I do agree with Bruce that the draft protocol that you have is not a, it's a good first draft. You need to go back and look at it again from a, where are we starting from? How can we really take these principles seriously? Anyways, okay, moving on, rights conflict. My notes are terrible, so I apologize I'm not answering these questions. But there were several, both Patrick and Eric, I think, had questions about the limitations to rights, what happens when rights conflict. I agree we need to be careful about the terms rights. Rights, it's sort of what are rights, what aren't rights. Rights are in the Charter, but we could imagine all kinds of rights that aren't in the Charter that are incredibly important to society. So we need to recognize that there are protected rights, but also recognize there are many, many other societal and community interests that do need protection, that do need to be taken into account. The ability to sleep is important. I like my sleep. You can't function without sleep. And when we get into protests or occupations that look like they won't end, these small interests, sleeping, carrying on my day, can grow into something that is really something you need to respond to. Is there a way that you can look at a protest that is always walking down this one residential street and say, hey, you know what, we need to let these people sleep. We can let the protest go, but maybe we can shift it over or have a rotating route so that we can both reconcile the interests and the needs of the community with a fundamental need to express things. So I think there are ways that you can accommodate, you can reconcile competing interests. I don't like balancing because that says one loses and one wins. I prefer reconciling interests. It takes participation, it takes dialogue, it takes a lot of work, and people may disagree at the end, but I do think it's important. Freedom of expression, including freedom from surveillance. I think this is actually really crucial. There's an enormous chilling effect when people are surveilled. It's enormous. And we're seeing it post G20. We know we had the largest covert spy operation in the history of Canada based on the G20. I mean, people should not be put under surveillance because they are dissenting, because they are disagreeing with those in power. It should be absolutely clear that dissent alone is not a reason to be watched. We need to be encouraging dissent, and this is an absolutely, you know, really easy way of putting a damper on the exact kind of conversations that we need to be having. So I think it's really important and definitely with all of the cameras we see at protests is increasingly relevant to both society. And if you tell me on McGill campus, then here as well.
Okay, Bruce, do you want to just add something on that?
A quick word on the issue of surveillance. It's obviously a really complicated issue, and I haven't given it a great deal of thought. But it does seem clear to me, as someone who spends a lot of time on a campus, that there needs to be security cameras in many contexts in order to promote safety and security on campus. And so my sense on that issue, at least on campus, is that there needs to be a well-defined protocol about what that film is used, what purposes it is used for. Because it seems to be me that it's very important from a security and safety point of view, but I agree with Abby that its role shouldn't be to monitor peaceful protest and assembly.
Thank you. So I know we've really taxed you, but we have one more short round of questions. We had three questionnaires and four. Aaron had a question as well. So let's start with you, Aaron, and then ask everyone else.
Thank you. So I'm moderating.
Dean's reminding me we only have 10 minutes, so we have to make these questions very
this
short.
This is a quick question, and it's from online, and it's from a person called Philippe Latour, and it's directed to David Mead. He asks, you have said that you thought there was a difference between the occupation of a space by students and the occupation of a space by other citizens. Can you explain a little bit more about what that means?
Since that's a question that's very punctuel, can we just get an answer now?
Yeah, I mean, I think the difference, and it really draws upon what's been said by speakers on both sides of me, it goes to the nature of a university than to ordinary citizens, that the nature of a university is for inquiring and critical reflection, etc. And so I think then there is a difference between the two. The difference, I suppose, also is the likelihood of it being in a more contained space, which I suspect goes the other way, that there's a finite space on campus, whereas in the open air, out in the city, there is much less. So there is a greater risk then of it being more disruptive. But I think there needs to be a graded response, that not all occupations on anywhere, but certainly on university campuses, are necessarily disruptive. Some may be. Clearly taking over a lecture theatre for a week would be. But there are places that one can occupy that would be much less so. So having a simple rule, a blanket response, would probably be would not be proportionate in legal terms.
Okay. Freedom of assembly or free speech is appropriate and should be protected in classrooms or offices. I mean, my personal opinion is you should give a broad protection to freedom of expression. If you're not protecting freedom of expression in a classroom, that's a problem. So you can imagine people standing up expressing their views, should they be sanctioned for that in the classroom context. I think that's actually a core place that you should protect freedom of expression. Now, the balancing, the justification mechanisms about what kinds of expression you restrict, why you restrict them, when it's appropriate, those are going to be different on a street versus in a classroom. But to rule out certain forms of expression or certain locations of expression from protection entirely really shortcuts the necessary balancing that you have to do. So I think we need to be careful about blanket rules. And really give a broad, generous, open interpretation to what you protect, and then careful, detailed look at what restrictions are appropriate when.
Thank you. So that's a highlight of what's going to happen next in the next panel as well. Thank you very much, Abby. So three short questions. Identify yourself, please. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Max. Given its historical validity, when do you think protests have the right to become violent? Say, when witnessing acts of police brutality, do protesters have the right and responsibility to prevent them from occurring?
Okay, thank you.
Hi, my name is Amelia. I'm a student here. I have a question concerning the provisional protocol, and the protocol that will be put in place afterwards. And I'd be be really interested to hear the panel's thoughts on this. I'm just questioning the validity of having a protocol at all. I know we're taking for granted that we're going to be having a protocol, and I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing or desirable, mostly because it seems that the protocol is coming out of, is stemming from these occupations that have happened that have been undesirable for many and at the same time desirable for others. And also given the system of governance in this university, I don't have a say whatsoever in what's put in the protocol, and it's an undemocratic decision, and it'll be made by a select few for a large number of people. Moreover, students at McGill already have a code of conduct. We already have rules regulating what we can and can't do. And finally, last point on this, given the history over the past two semesters about who's been protesting, it's been UNACA and students, and I'm just concerned that a protocol would be targeting specifically students or faculty members, given the history of protest on campus, the recent history. That's my question.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Last question.
Nikolaos, I'm surprised to see that people compare the right to protest with other daily needs of them. But anyway, on the surveillance, I'd like to ask Mr. Bruce Ryder if their campuses, when he was studying in the universities, were less safe because they didn't have cameras everywhere. In Britain, they have installed millions of cameras the last 10 years. Crime rate has been going up. I think it's completely irrelevant. Cameras are there for other reasons, for intimidation and control mainly. And on the violence, to extend on the question of the previous person, when the university thinks, or any state or any authority thinks that they have the right to respond with violence to something that they consider violent as a sit-in or an occupation, for example, and they have the right to respond with actual physical violence, what is that actually made the students or the citizens become violent? Is, for example, taking away the right to freedom, to access to education or healthcare, or the destruction of the environment, or fraud, election fraud, etc. Is that violent? Does that constitute violence? And should we be responding? Do we have the right to respond? If they have the right to respond with violence, do we have the right to respond with violence?
All right. So very large questions. But very short amount of time to answer them, I'm afraid. So let's start again with Bruce.
The question of whether protesters have a right to be violent or to respond with violence to infliction of violence. Personally, no. I don't think so. And you do have a right to self-defense, you have a right to defend others from violence, you have a right to defend property from destruction, but do you have a right to engage in violent protests? No. And I say that as a matter of democratic ethics, but I also say that as a matter of, as a constitutional lawyer, a human rights lawyer, I start with the way our commitments are framed at the national level, at the provincial level, at the international level, and it's a right to peaceful assembly that we're discussing this afternoon. And so there is no right to violent assembly, and I don't think it's consistent with the fundamental values of a university, which doesn't mean that you have to stand by when you're witnessing violence. It just means you don't respond with more violence. That seems to me to be really fundamental. The issue of surveillance, obviously it's a tricky one, and as I said, I haven't reflected a great deal on it. I'm not sure that I have a lot of wisdom to offer on it. But it's clear to me, I just think the debate is not about surveillance versus no surveillance, but the proper uses of surveillance. And if surveillance has been used for intimidation, if it has been used for improper kinds of monitoring, then that's a problem. But I don't think the answer is no use of closed-circuit television on campus or in buildings or other places. I just think we sacrifice so much in terms of safety by making that decision. But that's obviously a bigger conversation. Was it Amelia's question about whether we should have a protocol at all? is a protocol even valuable? I don't, my sense of the concern about that it's going to be drafted in through an undemocratic process or implemented in an undemocratic manner, or we already have a code of conduct, it'll be used to target particular students. To me, those aren't arguments against a protocol. They are arguments for a better protocol. I just don't see how you can go about dealing with these issues without having clarity, accountability, clear understandings, dialogue around well-understood norms, communicated to the community as a whole in a protocol. I think it has to be written, clear, and accessible. And again, that's what constitutional human rights norms dictate and require. And so the concerns, I think the right way to address those concerns that were raised is not to say let's abandon the task of having a protocol or let's be satisfied with the protocols we have. I don't think the protocols that McGill has, I don't think the protocols my university has are anywhere near as good as they could be. So I would like to see a better protocol drafted through a democratic process that includes all elements of the university community and administered in a democratic way as well.
Thank you. David.
I don't have much to add to that which Bruce has said. I mean, on that last point, and again, I don't mean this facetiously at all, but you should try being in a British university if you're arguing about protocols and things like that. We are light years away from having something like this, certainly at my own university and most other universities. And in terms of governance, I mean, we have gone drastically reduced student and faculty participation in decision, and I'm not aware of the specifics at McGill, but I would bet a lot of money that the governance at McGill and most other universities in Canada is an awful lot better than in my own university, taking my own, as I suppose I can see you nodding your head, but taking my own university as a specific, we have an emasculated faculty and student representation on that. That is not to say that you shouldn't be complaining about the protocol, nor about McGill, but a sense of perspective, I think, is very important on that. I don't have much to add to that which Bruce has said on violence either. I think I agree entirely with what he's said. You certainly have the right for self-defense, but I think we are in very dangerous waters if we start acting violently or exacerbate violence. You've removed... The question then is not about protesting. The question then is about the ordinary criminal law of responding to violence that has been imposed upon you. Nicholas, about the violence of the healthcare system, I mean, I think you raise a massively interesting and important question that I can't possibly do justice to in about 20 seconds. But there are real sort of political, out of my area, though I touch upon it, but really important issues about political participation, democracy, marginalised groups. And I know it was a specific question about healthcare, but you know there's a real need to discuss the extent to which democracies work. If they work properly and effectively, protest should be much less needed. But where they don't, we need it. And it depends upon your electoral system as well. I mean, you know, coming from the UK, we have got a history of governments that have governed with a majority of, you know, 65% of people don't want any government we've had since the Second World War. That is different where you have a system of... And I will finish on that. But I mean, there are really that I can't possibly do justice to, but they raise really big issues about the relevance of protest in a participatory democracy.
Thank you.
Yeah, I agree with everything that's... I sound like a broken record. I agree with everything that's been said, particularly about violence. And I think that we do live in a democracy. We do have democratic institutions. I view those as the appropriate forum for pursuing grievances. And protest is absolutely a central part of those democratic mechanisms. And we need to work continually to ensure that our democracy is responsive to marginalized groups, is actually reflecting the will of the people. We do not have a perfect democracy. I don't think that exists anywhere. So we always need to be very critical of the processes and procedures we have in place in order to pursue those things. But in terms of when is there a right for a protest to become violent, I agree with everything that's been said in terms of the dangers of responding to violence with violence. On the question of having a protocol at all, so this is actually a really relevant question for students to think about. We definitely, as a lawyer that does law reform, that does policy work, we do often, when we're saying, you know, what we think should be done, we do often look at who's going to be making this decision, who's going to be putting in place this law. If we call for this law, are we actually going to get something that we like because we have some input into the process? This, for me, doesn't say should there be a protocol or not. This, for me, says you need to be very vocal in terms of what kind of process you want to see leading up to the adoption of a protocol. You need to be demanding procedural rights, you need to be demanding input, you need to be demanding a response from the administration, and really advocate on behalf of yourselves to ensure that whatever gets put in place at the end of the day is something that at least you've had an input into and you can live with. Some people will not be able to live with it. That's a given. But I think the procedure for adopting is really, really key and needs to be appropriate and reflective of the principles that you hope that this should, you know, hold up. So, actually, I think
it's very interesting that we have three commentators from different parts of the world and also from different backgrounds who are agreeing on several points. And so I don't see it as a broken record. I see it as something that's actually quite instructive and interesting. My hope is that all of what's been said today, this dialogue and discussion, will be made available to the wider community of students and staff here at the university, because I think this has been an extraordinarily eye-opening discussion, both thoughtful and thought-provoking. And I'd like to thank Abby Deshman, David Mead, and Bruce Ryder for coming to McGill today and speaking to us and putting some context into some of the experiences that we've had here at the university, but also the larger questions around peaceful protest. Abby started out by saying that democracy is messy. And I think that this idea of trying to move away from the zero-sum game in terms of these questions on free expression and peaceful protest are hugely important for us to embrace, particularly in a university environment. So with that, j'aimerais ça vous remercier encore nos trois conférenciers, vous remercier aussi pour vos questions si pertinentes, vous inviter maintenant à le pause café, et nous allons reprendre les discussions à 3 heures avec ma collègue, le professeur Catherine Liu. So at 3 o'clock, we continue our discussions. Thank you again. Please join me in thanking our conference.